Welcome to episode 17 of season 2 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Friday the 6th of November 2009, and in this episode we are going to talk about whether Karmic has been a car crash, we'll cover the latest news and events, and we'll have an interview with Anna Nilsson. Then we'll do a competition, Ecosphere, and feedback. I'm Davey, and with this week are Tony.
Hello.
Hello, Tony.
Firstly, who are you? You know, what's this? Who are you? Why have you wandered into our studio?
Oh, what do you stranger. Mean? Do you mean I've been a stranger?
Yeah, I jest, of course, listeners. It's Dave. But it's nice to have you back with us.
Well,
and congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations to you and your missus.
Oh, yes, yes. You had Odd Camp, obviously, was the last episode.
Yeah.
And I was quite gutted to have missed that.
Yeah.
I was otherwise indisposed. I became a father for the second time, and it happened on the Saturday, which was the day before, and
yeah.
It made it sort of a bit of an inconvenient to go.
Well, we have got to talk to you about your priorities.
I know.
Clearly, you're not doing a good enough job.
Well, the thing is, it was crossing my mind whilst I was having my fingers broken with all the huffing and puffing of what goes on. I was thinking to myself, if she can hurry up, then I can probably still go.
Yeah.
But then I thought, wow, I might get in quite a lot of trouble if I do that.
Particularly if they give her lots of gas and air. She might not notice you've gone.
Oh, she hogged the gas and air the whole time. She would not share it.
Oh. Anyway, you did a very funny blog post about your new baby.
Oh, my new long-term LTS
long-term support release.
Yes.
So is that blog.davey.com?
Yes, yes. It's now the second blog post on there. Okay. But yeah, it was... Yeah, I wrote it up as a release talking, and I wrote it on behalf of the release manager because obviously she was a bit tired. I mean, feel free to check that out and leave comments and such.
Like the compatibility with the first release.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I had to, it was a bit tricky with that because it did cross my mind to write, well, you know, I had to make it clear that the first one was not superseded. It was just another release because obviously when you have a second child, you have to think about the first one, thinking you know they're not being replaced.
It's the whole Ubuntu Kubuntu thing, isn't it? Really, you know, we don't prefer one over the other. But
well, clearly we do, I can't admit that. I mean, you know, myself and Junior are already talking about going fishing and doing other fatherly son things.
Of course, because your first baby's a girl and this one's a boy, so presumably you're going to be, you know, taking him out to chop down trees and things.
Grow.
Yeah, and you know, manly going stuff. Down the bar and other very manly stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we did miss you, but obviously, you know, you had a kind of semi-legitimate excuse not to be there. I should explain also, if you can hear in the background, we haven't moved to Basra or somewhere like that. It's fireworks night here in the UK, and so there's lots of fireworks going off outside, which may sound a little bit like gunfire.
And for those that aren't in the UK, what our fireworks night is it's basically celebrating of our Houses of Parliament not getting blown up.
Yeah.
And with the current politics, I think people would actually celebrating it if they wish it was blown up.
The other way around.
I don't know. But
yes. So that's what you can hear in the background. It adds a little bit of flavour and excitement and danger. So what have you been doing other than having a baby for Ubuntu? you had not much time?
Well, I haven't had as much time as I wanted. There's already Lucid is being opened up, which is obviously the next release, and I have already actually upgraded the machine to Lucid, and it's I mean, just to sort of be a bit of a test drive to run it from scratch. I mean, clearly, I mean, it's pretty much still very Karmic-y, and
yeah.
You know, there's no real changes there, and I'm expecting it to break. But it's a spare machine, and I thought I'd run it from the total start of the release.
So yeah. Because
this week, the actual archives did open for Lucid, for people to upload stuff. We already had the first server meeting. One of the things that I've been tasked with this week is try and speak to the spam assassin upstream.
All right.
Because they haven't released for like a year and a half or so, and toying with the idea of running a sort of a trunk snapshot for Lucid. Just toying the idea. I've sent them an email to see whether they'll be happy with that, and really, or whether they have a release sort of planned in this Ubuntu time frame of the next sort of five months or so.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. Yeah. I mean, at home, I've upgraded. I'm running Myth TV under Karmic now.
Mm-hmm.
I added satellite for that, FreeSat.
Right.
Mm. Yeah, so we're getting. I mean, that's the only way to really get HD channels in the UK at the moment, is to run over satellite. Also set up Squid and Dan's Guardian.
Oh, the filtering proxy.
Yes, which...
Is this to protect your two-week-old baby from the evils of the internet?
I know. I mean, there's people out there, you know.
Or your missus.
But yeah, I mean, also as a... So not just that, but also a way of basically speeding up my internet connection as well, so I can... cache a lot of the things I go to, because I do go to quite a lot of the same sites quite regularly, and although the browser does caching, I do use multiple machines, so it makes sense to sort of cache it on the local network. But additionally, I've also added something called Banner Filter, and what you can use that is actually take out adverts before they even get to your machine. So for example, I've removed like AdSense and things like that.
Right.
And it's amazing, a lot of web pages that actually have adverts in, they look so much cleaner when you strip them out.
Wow.
You know, as in they actually look like use the whole screen rather than having sort of banners down each side. It just takes it out. So when you go to a network where you're not using that, it's a bit of a surprise to come across that.
Is that all?
I think I'll do for now.
I did wonder whether you were going to tell us everything you've done ever since the last couple of shows that you've not been in. So.
Quite a while.
Yeah.
But anyway, Tony, what have you been doing?
I've upgraded a load of systems. I had a load of things that were still running Intrepid, and now that OddCamp and Lug Radio Live are out of the way, I upgraded them all to firstly Jaunty, and then most of them onto Karmic already.
Of course, you can't just do it straight through. You have to leapfrog through each release, don't you?
Yeah, that's the advised way of doing it. I didn't bother to try and do it any other way, so I gave it a go, and other than a couple of software RAID problems, it was all fairly seamless, which is quite good.
Was that MDAD RAID, or was that...
Yeah, software RAID. It just didn't start the arrays on a couple of kernels, tweaked a bit.
Yes, and you poked it. I had exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
On a fresh install... Well, it was a fresh install I migrated to be RAID afterwards, and I had the same bit. I had to rebuild the init RAM thing,
I had it on... two different systems, so it's obviously a bit of, well, there is a bug filed about it on Launchpad, so it's known about.
Yeah.
What about you, Laura?
I've installed Karmic on an empty machine, and it went smoothly.
Excellent.
And I installed that, and then I installed some of the software that we need at work, which is nicely being put together by Anton. And it just installed, and whereas like you can run a Windows installer for hours.
Yeah.
This was on in about half an hour, plus the packages is the best part of an hour, if that. And it was just so nice.
Excellent.
But that's not for me.
Yeah. And Alan and Simon are watching fireworks tonight, so I believe. Not with each other.
No.
And they're not sat outside the studio either, with their wellies on and their sparklers.
You listen very carefully, you might hear the ooh, ah.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get on with it.
Sounds like a fun-packed show.
Ubuntu Karmic has not long been out, only in the last couple of weeks, but it's already caused some headlines. There was quite a good bit of good press when it was first released, and it's now started to generate some rather more negative headlines.
Yeah, I mean, the good stuff is it was demonstrated on BBC.
Yes,
wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah,
Graphically, there's been quite a lot of changes, like the boot-up sequence and things like that. But some people have actually had not so good experiences. Some of the things people quoted is like sound issues and...
issues with the NVIDIA driver playing back movies looking all blue. Something there was a blue haze over them or something.
Yeah, but
not blue movies, blue picture.
And MP expenses. And,
yeah.
And, I know that on Hardy, I believe, I was running an ATI graphics card, who's a proprietary driver. I got a blue tint on that. So things like that aren't anything new.
They're also not going away by the look of it.
No.
But one of the unusual things for me about this is that, in fact, it's reached some of the more mainstream IT press, like The Register, which does get read by an awful lot of people who work in the IT industry.
And The Register is traditionally Linux's friend, really.
Yeah, I mean, generally, yeah.
They tend to slant towards good favour stuff in Linux and be more critical of proprietary software.
Yeah, but the headline they've got here is Early Adopters Bloodied by Ubuntu's Karmic Koala. Ubuntu 9.10 is causing outrage and frustration with early adopters wishing they'd stuck with previous versions of the Linux distro.
Yeah, which is quite hard-hitting, really. Mm. And I do wonder quite how many sources they actually got that from.
Probably only, well, maybe only a handful, but it only takes a handful, and they've verified it, and they've written an article about it.
But, I mean, if you have any product, you're going to have
bad examples of that. And I don't just mean a software, you know, for every 100 sort of people that buy a model of car, there's going to be a few people that find things they really don't like about them. And people tend to be more vocal about stuff which doesn't work well. I've been running Karmic for quite a while now before it's released, and running the machines it's now on a stable, I can't really report any major killer problems on the desktop. I haven't blogged about the fact I've had a good experience, but people do tend to be more vocal when they have a bad experience.
Yeah, that's it. You please one person and they might tell one other person. You annoy somebody and they tell 20 other people.
Yeah, yeah.
But some of the issues... Now, I know Windows has problematic upgrades, but some of the issues that we've seen in terms of Ubuntu upgrades... You and I have both had a similar issue when we've been doing upgrades recently using with software RAID, and we've both had to fix the problem.
To be fair, mine wasn't an upgrade. Mine was a fresh install.
Okay.
Mine was actually creating a single disk but it was the same issue.
We both had essentially the same issue, and I had it on two different machines. So we've all had this issue, and you and I are system administrator type people who can go away and fix these things. Now, maybe less technically minded users wouldn't be using software RAID and stuff, but you know, those problems would have stumped them. They'd have stumped, you know, my parents if they'd happened to see that message on a screen. And I wonder whether the expectation that every upgrade will just work flawlessly is unreasonable given the complexity of a modern Linux distribution.
I think there is the argument that people who aren't sort of technical or geeky or whatever wouldn't be doing the actual installation themselves, like on a fresh machine. They'd have it installed for them. But the update manager makes it really, really easy to upgrade because it alerts you when there's a new version released and you press the button.
Yeah. I mean, something Tony touched on a few minutes ago, he said about, you know, Windows, there is sometimes a problem upgrading. But the thing is, Windows doesn't release every 6 months. And also, they're not so pinned to a release date. Although, I think in Ubuntu's history, it has only missed one planned release, and that was Dapper.
That was Dapper, yeah.
Yeah. But so, although it's only missed one, it is kind of quite a strict date, and there has to be something quite major to block the release. Now, with Windows, they are always slipping on their intended dates, from my experience at least. I mean, it does raise the issue, is releasing every 6 months too often? And also, what is a release for every 6 months?
Well, should we be looking at those six monthly release as a experimental?
Well, it's,
you know, as long as it's not a long term support.
It's funny you say that, because for this release cycle, a lot of my work has been aimed at the actual server version, and we were having a discussion in our meeting a month or so ago, and I raised the issue saying, actually, you know. Because someone said, oh, we shouldn't target this for this release. And I thought, well, you know, really, this is a proper release, you know. So I said, should we really be considering sort of a non-stable release? And actually, at the time, it was the actual server manager, I believe. He actually come back and said, well, yes, that's all it is. And someone else said, it's a technology preview. A non-LGS server release is a technology preview, which shocked me a little bit, really, because I never really considered it like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, LTSs are every 2 years, aren't they?
Yes.
Which I think is way too far apart to wait for a stable release.
Well,
I'd happily... I mean, I at the moment at work, I'm using Intrepid, and I only moved to that about 3 months into Intrepid's lifetime. But I'd quite happily go with a 12-monthly cycle and skip, you know, not bother upgrading in between. But I wouldn't want to wait 2 years, because that's ages, and everything. Firefox is out of date, and everything everybody else has moved up to, I can't move up to.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, if we look how Debian does it, they release when it's ready. And having those 6 months really puts you under pressure to make sure it's out the door, because it's very easy for dates to slip and things like that. And Debian doesn't have a release date as such. People estimate. But, I mean, Debian works differently. Rather than having a sort of 6 month development cycle, there's the sort of three versions, isn't there? There's unstable, testing, and stable.
Yeah.
And packages cascade through the versions until stable is stable, and then it's shipped.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in some ways, that actually makes quite a lot of sense to do it in that sort of schema, doesn't it? But, I mean, I know some people actually run testing as a matter of course. You know, that is their stable machine. Mm.
It's a compromise. They get slightly newer versions of the packages, but it's not totally unstable.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it's fair or not, but some people do actually call Debian stable Debian stale, because quite often it can be quite old.
Yeah. But
that's what I mean about the LTS. That's why I wouldn't want to stay on it. Now, if you're sort of installing for an office where it's totally non-technical people and they just use whatever they're given, then fine. But I want to be able to use a stable enough desktop that I can do my work on it. But I need it to be fairly up to date.
And also, upgrading every 6 months is actually quite a chore. Because,
which is why I don't do it.
Although it's quite straightforward, as you rightly pointed out, you might expect there to be some headaches, which you, I don't know whether it's right or wrong, but you know, it is time you have to set aside to actually do that, and particularly on a slow internet connection as well, because from the live CD that people get from Ship It or buy that, you can't actually upgrade from the live CD, can you?
No.
You have to use the alternate CD, which is downloadable only. So, you know, it's, if you've got a slow internet connection, you're in a bit of a bad position, really.
As someone, Davey, who's been involved with the developing side of releases, what do you find in terms of the 6-monthly release, that it's good in terms of encouraging people to keep on top of the bug fixing and getting a good quality release every 6 months so that it doesn't just degenerate over the 12 months? Or is it such an overhead to have to do that every 6 months that it actually doesn't benefit?
Well, I mean, I can really answer that in sort of two ways. One of the things I was working on is Asterix, and sort of about 2 weeks or so before release, there was still things I really wanted to try and squeeze out. Like, I wanted to change the way it starts. For example, this release, a lot of things moved to Upstart, which is a way of launching applications, particularly sort of daemons and servers and things. But I wasn't really getting a reliable one that was, I didn't really have time to test it. So I did get very frustrated towards the end. I was thinking, I'd really like an extra month on this. You know, it's so tight, so stressful, I found for that. But another point you actually raised about sort of losing focus on previous releases, and yes, that has happened. One of the other things I've worked is the Myth TV area. And I know that some bugs we've actually marked as won't fix that are on still supported releases, but the development focus has moved forward, and you feel bad doing that. But the trouble is it's limited resources, and you can't. There's not enough manpower to do everything.
How long are previous releases maintained for?
Well, non-LTS ones are 18 months.
Okay.
So you know you're actually exponentially, you know, creating quite a workload, and also, then you have to have test environments, and quite often a virtualized one isn't quite enough, particularly when you're doing stuff with hardware, like with Myth TV, you're caring about tuners and things like that. So, you know, having a virtualization isn't necessarily enough. So you need to stay current with each one, and particularly when the actual upstream application is changed quite significantly, it can be quite a headache, really, I think. So, you know, although the 6 months thing really does pack a punch with putting so much work into a tight area, you sort of feel, towards the end of it, you think, oh man, I just really, you know, frustration and wanting a break, because you really feel that you really want to get this done, but it's just the lack of time. Whereas if it was similar to the sort of way the Debian works, you think, well, you know, I've still got a bit of time because we're not in, you know, because they have quite a long time between releases.
Yeah, but they don't have the rhythm, I guess, of...
Well, that's what it is. Yeah. It's the motivation. I mean, in a previous job, I worked at somewhere where, under new management, what they did is they said, oh, people are waiting for this new application. We've got to get this out the door. This is the date. It's got to go out. And so we were, and I was still at the office going towards midnight. And so we got it out on the date, and we thought, oh, you know, really satisfied that we managed to get it to the date, and we'd be pleasing all the customers that were waiting for these new features. And in the first month, we had about 3 downloads. And it was a management style of basically keeping the pressure there to get the task done. Mm. But when you realise actually there wasn't really that need there, it felt quite disappointing, actually. And I think for the following release, that sort of left its mark, I think, in many of the developers that are working on that project.
Well, the other aspect is that initially, in like the early releases of Ubuntu, there was a lot happening in each release, and you could look from one release to the next in 6 months and see the massive differences. And now there doesn't seem to be that much difference. And possibly because there's a lot more underlying stability stuff being done and things, and that takes up the time, which is fine. But again, it kind of makes me not especially inclined to upgrade unless there's some specific thing that needs fixing.
Yeah, so one of the things that really went into this one is the new way it boots up. So we've got Grub 2 as installed by default, mm-hmm. And we've also got the way applications spawn at the same time, whereas traditionally you would start one, then the next, then the next, then the next. In many ways, a lot of them are being thrown, saying, okay, just start all these together. So your computer works really hard to boot up, but in long term, it should reduce the actual boot time. So, I mean, as you say, that's one of the underlying things. But also, the actual boot sequence is actually a lot prettier now. You know, as in, we've got
that's
the...
true, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are some features there. I mean, some people have been quite critical of the artwork in this release, haven't they?
They're always critical of the artwork.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the actual desktop background didn't bowl me over, to be honest. I mean, the actual login screen I found to be much prettier, and the actual theme there. But the default desktop background possibly could have been a bit prettier. I don't know.
I'm not entirely sure this is in any way relevant to what we're trying to talk about, which is whether the release cycle is too much, and whether people have the unreasonable expectations in terms of the stability or the usability of new Ubuntu releases. I mean, it's new features that are coming to Karmic, sure. But, you know, John O'Boken wrote a blog post saying that, you know, the criticism that this new release has had is a symptom of its success. And is actually Ubuntu, because it's being used by more and more people, when you do a release, you suddenly get unprecedented numbers of people trying it out and finding bugs that the test people haven't, you know, that the testers haven't yet found. Should more people be trying the early release, the betas or whatever?
Well, yeah, I mean, I entirely agree. I mean, someone said in a previous episode that it's actually a duty of Ubuntu user to actually do testing, which I'm not sure I really agree with.
Yeah. No, me neither.
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily, although I did actually have my parents running Karmic before it was released, I wasn't expecting them to report bugs. I was expecting them to use it as normal users, and then if they have a problem, they tell me, and then I investigate right. and report it if necessary. And they did that involuntarily, to be honest. They weren't aware they were running a development version.
so perhaps that's sysadmin.
Yeah, perhaps that was a little bit unfair. I don't know. But, I mean, something, I think it might be yourself that said that, if you don't, I mean, if a bug gets reported like a day or two after release, well, if someone's capable of reporting a bug that soon after release, then they really, that they could have been testing, because I think every free software project often suffers from not enough testing, because to be honest, that's not the sexy part.
No,
the sexy part is developing, and I don't think people are all that excited about doing testing, and it's really the developers that do the testing, which is, you know, if you look at it as a proprietary development way, that's really quite dirty. I mean, although there is a Ubuntu QA team, I think they are quite overworked.
Yeah, and they can't test every single combination of hardware and things that's out there in the real world.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's something that Mac really benefits from, is the fact they've got a platform designed from scratch, and they know exactly what's going to work on there, so their QA is possibly a lot easier. I mean, a Ubuntu computer could be anything from, you know, a computer that's 10 years old to a supercomputer, which is unfair.
MattB90 on Twitter touched on this, actually, and he said that maybe it is hard for any operating system to be tested on all environments, and experiences will vary. This is maybe something that where OSS can take a lead, but because you've got that wider range of users potentially reporting bugs and things.
So something actually you mentioned earlier about it being very easy to upgrade. One of the hidden features of do release upgrade, which is the command line application for actually doing the update, which I think we touched on before.
We've mentioned it before, yeah.
Yeah. That's actually got a feature that isn't very well documented, that allows you to actually do a sort of experiment upgrade.
Okay. Yeah.
Where basically what it does is it does it as an overlay to the current one. So what you can do is you can just delete that, and then you've got your normal one back. And I'm not saying this is a good way to actually test as such, but I think it's an interesting concept to basically allow people to easily test drive on the upgrade, and also running it under their own local environment. I mean, something I've traditionally done is if it's a computer I depend upon, but I still want to test it on there, is I might dual boot the current stable one and the development one. And then if I boot up and the development ones won't boot, or there's a temporary issue, I can just reboot, and then at the boot selection screen, I can boot the other one. Sharing the same home partition, which is bit controversial, because if you're running an application that automatically updates your configuration files, you could be left stuffed. But
it's generally all right.
But I've been doing that for probably about 3 years now, and I've never really experienced a problem with that. So I think that more people could and should, and you know, to actually get the latest buzz of seeing the features as they appear, it is quite an interesting concept, and you know, it would be really good to have more people testing, I think.
Yeah, again, touching on that kind of thing, Charles Yarnold on Dintica.
No, I read that as Charles Y. Arnold at first. But...
Oh, yeah, Charles Y. Arnold. Or Charles Arnold, whichever.
Charles.
Let us know. If you can't expect to have minimal problems with upgrading, it shouldn't be as easy to initiate, which is kind of what I was saying before.
Yeah.
That said, he's had few problems. But touching on what Davey was just saying, maybe it's more a case of better managing the upgrade experience from the Ubuntu perspective, so it gives you it will do this sort of test upgrade, and when you're happy with it, you say, yes, I'm happy, move on, or roll it back.
That's kind of helpful, but most of the problems that I've experienced, which again have been fairly few and far between, have been things that only show up at the reboot time. They've been kernel issues or disk issues, you know. But I am more guilty perhaps than some people, is that I rarely run the development version. I've only just recently upgraded my Intrepid machine to Jaunty and then to Karmic. But I'm not sure you should feel guilty for that, because if everybody was supposed to be running the development version, you wouldn't bother to do stable releases.
Yeah.
Whether long-term support or not.
I mean, I hope I haven't misconveyed myself and saying everyone should. I'm just saying that if you're capable and you've got the time and the motivation to, then it's not basically closed to a select few of people.
Oh, no.
It is open, because I mean, everyone, when release day happens, basically the internet goes crazy of people saying, is it out yet? Well, you know, yes, it's officially out, but you could have been running it a week ago, you know.
Well, look, before we started the show tonight, we were discussing it briefly and we were saying about the idea that people install it after release day and then start raising loads and loads of bugs. And there's an argument of why weren't they doing this before release day. But I think one of the aspects is that until you start using it properly, you don't necessarily hit the bugs that you want to that you will then subsequently raise on Launchpad. And if that work machine, if that machine is something you rely on, you don't want to be running a development environment on it. So,
and also because you're reporting these things on Launchpad, and anybody can see them and subscribe to them and hear all the chatter about these bugs, unlike a closed development environment, such as Microsoft Windows 7 or whatever, it might seem that there's more going wrong than actually there is in comparison with another operating system. It's just that you don't have access to their support ticketing system in Microsoft's terms. And just the very fact that, you know, this release of Ubuntu is being actively compared with Windows 7. Now, okay, they released around the same time as each other, so that it does help. But, you know, a Linux distribution is being compared in the mainstream media with the biggest dominant operating system in the market. It's fantastic progress.
Yeah.
It's something the last social network person came up with.
Yep.
They're saying it shouldn't be so easy to upgrade. Well, I mean, if we look at the concept again of, you know, perhaps people should be using LTSs if they really depend on their computer, an LTS release, although the upgrade path is to go to the next release, either the next direct release or the next LTS.
Okay.
The LTS release will only prompt for you to upgrade to the next LTS release. So you actually have to do some tomfoolery for it to know. So for example,
discuss the intermediate ones.
Yeah. So if we go to Hardy to the non-LTS release of Intrepid, you have to do some tomfoolery for that to actually happen. It doesn't come up with a little notification window saying there is an upgrade available to a new one, whereas it does do that on non-LTS ones, and it does do that from LTS to LTS one. So, you know, things are starting to point towards, well, if you really depend on your computer, perhaps you should be using an LTS. I mean, that's what an LTS there is for.
Yeah, I mean, people using Windows XP have been using it for 7-8 years with very little change in terms of new features. They've been able to add extra applications and stuff,
I think you can, because, I mean, you can run, say, Firefox 3.5 3.5 on Windows XP.
True.
Whereas you're on Ubuntu, I'm sure you can hack it, but the easiest way is just to stick what you've got.
But in some ways, actually, that's a downside of the whole Linux distribution model, is that you don't need to upgrade a load of other stuff, but generally you upgrade a load of other stuff in order to get the latest version of, say, OpenOffice or Firefox. Whereas perhaps you're quite happy with the version of Mines that's included. I suppose we should just conclude. Alan's not here today, but he did blog about this as well a couple of days ago. And one of the things he concludes is, you don't have to upgrade. The version of Jaunty is still supported for another year or whatever it will be. In fact, there's multiple supported releases, including long-term support releases. Don't feel you have to do it. On the whole, they do work, but there's a great community and a great support structure. If you do have issues, make use of them. Make use of Launchpad or the IRC channels or the forums or whatever it is. And I think it's fair to say that we've had quite a few people commenting on this evening on Twitter and Identica. But generally, the comments have been, I might have had a small issue or something, but basically it's worked.
It's fairly positive in our unscientific sample.
Yeah, a terribly unscientific sample of listeners. But, they seem to have had good experiences. And maybe there are just a few people who have been frustrated who are who are quite vocal about it. But yeah, send us your views into the usual address, podcast@ubuntu-uk.org, or any of the other methods.
Microsoft have released a roadmap for the release of Document in the PST file, the data store for Outlook accounts. The documentation will be released under their interoperability standards and may help open source projects extract data from existing Outlook data stores as part of migration to a new email client.
Yeah, this is quite interesting, because one of the few things that we don't know how to poke and interrogate is a .pst file, but yet they're everywhere.
Well, I'm a bit of a noob to this area, but I understand there are a lot of projects that have proprietary connectors for this sort of stuff. Mm. One that comes to mind is the Zimbra. You can get Zimbra for free under open source, but their open source license. However, if you want to use your Outlook with it and get all the bells and whistles with Outlook, you have to pay extra. Now, I'm not sure this is the same thing, but it might make it a lot easier to have an open source interaction with Outlook.
And Evolution used to have to screen scrape Outlook web access.
Oh, that's lovely.
Originally, which is I guess it's the only way they could have done it, but it's a horrible hack. And there's a potential here that they could actually interrogate these files directly and get all the data out, and Evolution could become an Outlook front end, sort of.
Yeah, I mean, Outlook already, I mean, Evolution and Outlook, they are pretty similar already, aren't they?
Yeah, that's true. Skype will soon to be a bit less evil than it used to be, as an open source version of their VoIP client has been announced. However, it looks like it's only the user interface which is being released, but this should at least make integration between Skype and the Linux desktop environments better.
Yeah, see, this is quite interesting, because in order for some of my voiceover IP stuff, I actually run the Skype client in a fake X session and actually connect via their API to their current client. So if you basically still get proprietary libraries, but you can connect to it using your own code, then that is quite exciting. I actually only learned this week that Copete, which is
the KDE messenger thing,
equivalent like Pidgin or Empathy or something, that already actually has some support for this. I haven't tried it myself, but that's something I learned this week. It's just a shame it's only the UI stuff and not the library stuff. But still,
it'd be nice to see it sort of integrated with the menu and the away status and things that, is all part of the GNOME desktop that we've seen over the last couple of releases.
Yeah, because, the QT look of the Skype client always looked a bit foreign on a Linux desktop, I always thought.
So does this mean that we can or we can't use it for the podcast, if it's sort of half open source?
Well, we are sort of using it already for our voicemail.
But people can use it, but they don't have to use it.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, but I mean, like, for like recordings iTunes and things.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
probably not.
With Studio A's bandwidth, I'm not sure we could get away with having us. And also, when we're both sat next to each other on the same chair, it
I was thinking more if you got stuck in the deepest, darkest depths of the sticks.
Yeah, otherwise known as home. A new group has been founded for all those interested in promoting Linux and Floss to the unaware. The group is called the Linux Dairy Council. presumably a reference to lactose pimping quangos.
Yeah, it's all about promoting Linux to people who have never heard of it and to get the word out, in the same way that the Milk Marketing Board used to put slogans and posters in schools and things like that.
In case you hadn't heard of milk.
In case you didn't drink enough milk and your teeth fell out.
Linux Theory Council, who are they?
Exactly.
Yahoo have donated the source code for their Traffic Server, a high-performance application server for builders of cloud services, to the Apache Software Foundation through their Incubator project. Yahoo hopes to build a community around the project, improving it for everyone else as well as themselves.
Dave, you know about clouds. Is this exciting?
Well, we'll have to wait and see, to be honest, because I haven't really heard about the Traffic Server stuff, to be honest. It's quite new to me, so I'm going to wait to see what basically they drop. And I would like to read up on that a bit more.
A lot of people have said that it's just a good way for Yahoo to keep maintaining their product, but now that they've not got as many developers as they used to have.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of applications and companies that do that. When it's stuff they don't really want to maintain in-house anymore, they throw it out to the community and basically get people working on it for free, so everyone wins.
Yeah, it's all more code, isn't it? It's all good.
And Yahoo are quite helpful to this free software. I mean, we always get, like Radio Live, we always get the Yahoo developer keyrings, don't we?
I haven't had those for a couple of years, but yes, they were very useful.
Every year.
We've got some events coming up, and the next one is the Ubuntu Developer Summit in Dallas, Texas, on the 16th to the 20th of November. So that's only next week or week after. Dave, you're going, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I fly out next Friday.
Have you got a big hat ready to wear, a big 10-gallon hat?
Have you booked a hotel room?
Yes, I'm actually sharing with Augusto, I hope I pronounced that correctly. He's the Wooby guy.
The Wooby guy.
Ah.
Yes. Yeah, I'm actually sharing. He's my roomie.
Oh, he's a really nice guy.
He's your Woomie.
He's your Woomie.
My Woomie.
I got that first.
Well, you'll have to report back for us, because I think we're definitely not going.
I mean, you might actually be recording whilst me and Alan Pope are still there.
Yes.
So you could potentially give us a call and, you know, we could give you a quick insight about what's going on.
Maybe we could use Skype it from there. There's the Scottish Open Source Awards on the November the 20th.
At the prestigious Forum Building at Edinburgh University.
And there's FOSDEM on the 6th to the 7th of February in 2010 at the University of Libre Brussels. Or Brussels, still.
We still not fix that.
You can find out more at fosdem.org.
You guys going?
Hopefully. Yeah. Haven't really looked at it yet, but time is ticking on now. Yeah, it's not so far away. It's only a couple of months.
And that's Laura Kaczewski said that...
she's going. She's got her hotel booked.
Yeah, I was actually talking today about actually booking the actual Eurostar to get there. Last year, I had everything booked, but... thanks to 18 inches of snow, I couldn't really get in my house. So I was quite gutted about that.
Falling at the first hurdle, really.
Yes, yeah. I mean, if I had a 4x4, I'd probably have been okay, but there we go.
We're here on the landing outside the toilets and the pub after Os Barcamp with Anna Nelson, who gave a talk this afternoon about automating documentation. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so... what is your profession? Why are you interested in automating documentation?
Well, my PhD is actually in economics. I got into computational economics, and that was sort of a slippery slope into programming. And I got into automating documentation when I was writing my thesis and decided that, you know, manually typing numbers out of a statistical analysis into a LaTeX document wasn't really such a great idea, especially when you had to rerun your simulation and the numbers all changed. So I started, I suppose I got interested in it, you know, quite a while ago when I was doing that. And then after I finished and started working in industry and finance, I started realizing that, well, you know, this issue of running calculations or doing any sort of work and then having to update a document that depends on something like that, you know, is a fairly common issue that arises in a lot of different venues. So, I mean, today I was talking about a specific application, which was working with software documentation. But I suppose that the area is more, you know, has more a broad interest.
So you're talking about things that could essentially be automated but hadn't historically been?
Well, I think they've been automated historically in some ad hoc situations, but in general, documentation, with a few exceptions, hasn't been automated, or at least not to the extent that it could be. And it hasn't been automated in a way that fits in nicely with people's workflows and makes it a natural process to document.
I mean, I'm rather aware of using creating documentation for applications but based on the source code, doing that automated. But some of the things you touched on in your talk were actually creating things which aren't related to programming. So the actual tools you use, what are they, and were they actually designed for using things which aren't related to programming?
Well, I suppose yes and no. I mean, the tool I use that kind of knits everything together is a fantastic tool called Webby, which it's a Ruby gem, and it was written. Its stated purpose is to generate static websites. It's actually a fantastic tool for generating any kind of static content. So you set up layouts, which is just sort of any sort of layout and sort of like in terms of a HTML sort of layout.
A template or something.
A template. And then you'll write pages that can use whatever template you want, and you can put any sort of dynamic content you want within that template. So the original intent was to use this as a, you know, for websites, for generating websites with, you have all your CSS and your navigation built into the layout. But it's a tool that's built well enough that it can be applied to any number of scenarios. And so I find it works fantastically well for writing very complicated LaTeX documents, where you can use all this layout and templating to generate LaTeX or any kind of text file you want. So for me, it's worked out very well for doing software documentation, but also for doing any kind of document where you have a template that has to incorporate information that's likely to change, or where you want to build in the results of running some other script or running some other computation.
So is this something that is currently in use by projects, or something that you'd like to see further uptake of?
It's something I use in a number of projects myself. Like, I've built a few of the tools myself. I've ported a few of the tools into Ruby from other languages. It's not quite a ready-to-go coherent package at the moment. I hope it will be within a couple of months, because it is something I use myself in production quite regularly. I know plenty of other tools use, obviously Webby is in very, very broad use in terms as a blogging tool and as a website generation tool. For a number of websites use Webby. A number of projects use Webby. It's some of the components, but in general, the whole suite isn't, as far as I know, in broad use at the moment, but I hope it will be soon.
I thought it was really interesting, because from the title, I kind of expected it to be about generating all the content, like maybe Java doc is almost, but it was more kind of enabling easy maintenance, wasn't it? As you say, sort of anything that might change. And that, I mean, that's a real problem, because I've worked in technical writing and you just have to manually update everything typically.
Yeah, and I think what's nice is the nice thing about the way Webby works and the way the package I've put together works is that you can use any sort of templating language, and that means you can put any variable into any location in your document. So, for instance, Webby happens to be written in Ruby, so you can run whatever code you want to beforehand, and whatever's available to you in terms of calling the result of a function or what's stored in a variable can be put into any location in the document. So it is very useful as a form of software documentation. I mean, ironically, the one thing I haven't been able to do with it, and this is more the fault of RDoc, is actually integrate automated JavaDoc style documentation. It's something I'd very much like to do, and it's something I'll certainly look into. But for me, what's very powerful is that you can write a generic template, and using, at the moment I use Herb, because that's the default in Webby and default in Ruby, but in principle, any generic templating system, and you can insert any function call or any variable into any point in your document. And that means if you want to write HTML and insert the results of a Python script, you can do that. If you want to write LaTeX and insert the results of a Ruby script, you can do that. And if you know, basically whatever combination you want to do, that's the flexibility of just working with open source and working with plain text, is that you can just incorporate any data in any format into any document, as long as the templating system supports that.
So in the one of the examples you gave, I think, was generating Excel documents, and what the output of that was graphically. So it would literally produce the screenshot based on running the generator that generated the Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that is my favorite example, and it's basically what I ported a Python library for creating Excel spreadsheets. into Ruby, and I was trying to work out how to write the documentation for that. And basically, in order to demonstrate the effect of the various formatting commands, you know, you, with the nice thing about an Excel spreadsheet is you can really format the page to look exactly how you want. You have a lot of control, and you have a very nice cell-based system, so you can really do a very, you know, a very nice tabular layout. But obviously, if you want to document that, you know, you need to be able to show a screenshot of the effect of, okay, if I call, you know, format and enter the text and then apply a bold and an 18-point font, and, you know, what does that actually look like? So the nice thing is, because I have a very generic, you know, because Webby is based on Rake, which is just a very generic automation framework, you can incorporate pretty much any Ruby script you want, and that means you can, you know, incorporate pretty much anything you want. So I was able to work it out. Ruby has very good AppleScript integration. I was able to work out a really nice system where it would actually open Excel, open an Excel file, which we had just created by running some commands in Surpass, and actually take the screenshot. And so the documentation was set up in such a way that you could just basically run, you know, run the code, generate an Excel file, create a screenshot, and work that into the document. And so the beauty of it is, if any part of that changes, if Excel changes, if the Ruby, if the function call changes, if any of it changes, you can update everything in one go.
One of the other examples you gave was updating a PowerPoint presentation. So, for example, if you had to do monthly statistics to present to your employer or something, I was interested, how do you actually do that? Do you actually edit the actual save file, or do you actually somehow actually load that? And what tools can you actually do that with?
Okay, well, that particular example was based on using a COM server called RCOM, which is the basis of R, Excel, and a number of other tools. It's just RCOM, and if you basically, there's a tool that's been built based on that called R2PPT. So it's R the number 2 PPT, and that will actually specifically integrate the R statistical framework with PowerPoint. So if you have a script set up in R, which will generate some numbers and perhaps some graphs, R2PPT will let you dynamically drive PowerPoint to create slides and paste images and input data wherever you want. So basically, what that will do is let you dynamically update a framework. Now, I presume you will start with a template and insert information where you want, or you could drive it from scratch and basically import data where you want. So
what are the primary data formats that you want to integrate with? Obviously, Excel and PowerPoint for business things. Are there other formats that you can talk about, LaTeX as well?
In terms of data or output?
Output.
Output. I mean, for me, like in a business context, you pretty much are down to PDF and Excel as a practical level. And if you need to give someone a printable static document, it's going to be PDF, because that's just something that everyone can open, and, you know, they won't be able to, you know, they don't need to mess with it or do anything strange. They can just print it out. And if you need to give somebody information that is that they want to play around with, perhaps Excel is a fantastic framework for giving people either printable reports or things that they can play around with. PowerPoint would be for someone, I would primarily envision PowerPoint being if people want to use it themselves. So if you want to automate your own workflow, PowerPoint's a great tool for that. If that's something you have to use, if you have to make presentations, especially if you have to make the same presentation on a regular basis, fantastic tool for that.
Cool. So are you looking for people to help out?
Absolutely. I mean, there's Webby is a very fairly mature framework at this stage. Obviously, one of the things with Webby is I would love to see Webby ported into other languages, because I think it's a fantastically written framework. It's by Tim Pease, and it's a great framework. I would love to see that in other languages. The things I've developed are Gorgorella, which is a port of a Python library called Idiopide. And I've just started working on something called Dobby, which is basically, that's a long story. Dobby basically will take an interpreted language, and it will run it a line at a time, and it will let you display the output of running those commands into your document. Gorgorella is fairly solid at this stage. Dobby is very, very early days, so certainly if anyone is interested in contributing, I'd be delighted to hear from them as far as porting to other languages or making it more solid.
So where can they get in touch?
My own website is annanelson.com, annanelson.com. You can certainly get in touch with me that way and find links to all the projects. Most of the projects, these are Ruby libraries, as it happens. They're available on RubyForge. So it's webby.rubyforge.org, Gorgorella, G-O-R-G-Y-R-E-L-L-A, or Dobby, all at RubyForge. Or, of course, you know, Google is the front end to everything. So
you actually mentioned a whole bunch of tools there, and you say on your website you link to a lot of different projects. Do you actually have documentation you've written or other people have written that actually ties that all together on how to do that?
I mean, the best place to look at the moment is I've actually used this particular suite of packages to document two libraries that I've developed. One is called Surpass, which is the Excel library we mentioned earlier, and Surpass is a port of a Python library called XLWT. So the Surpass documentation actually uses a lot of this functionality itself. Another one is BloombergAPI.com, which actually also uses a lot of this functionality. So because these processes are still in development, I've actually, the best way to look at it at the moment is to look at this third-party documentation, and obviously once it gets to the point where it's a little bit more stable, I'll be developing as documentation and possibly some screencasts of using the whole suite as kind of a package for actually documenting every aspect of a project.
Well, it's certainly something that's very in-depth. There's a lot to it. And thank you for kind of compressing an hour-long talk into a sort of a 15-minute info burst, I guess.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. And I think the best thing, obviously, with all these is just, if you can look at the source of some of these things, that's going to be the best way to learn it at this point. Because it is, it's still in development, it's still early days. I mean, what I particularly like is the ability to have your website and maybe some PDF documentation and all this in just one package, which is, the flexibility of Webby that really lets you do all that, which is fantastic. So I'm certainly, building on some great tools out there, and it's very worthwhile for me to bring it all together, and it's great to make. I mean, this is primarily tools I've built for myself to make my own life easier. So I'd certainly be delighted if other people found that it made their lives easier as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you for talking to us.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Time for the results from our competition that we had in two episodes ago. Competitions from two episodes ago. There were two prizes, both books. One was the Drupal book, Front End Drupal by Emma Jane Hogbin, and the second one was the Ubuntu Server Companion. Is that right?
Nope.
Oh, go on then, correct me.
Beginning Ubuntu.
Beginning Ubuntu, sorry, by Keir Thomas. Go on, Laura, what was the question and the winner of the Drupal book?
Okay, the question was, what was the name of the episode of UUPC in which we interviewed Emma Jane Hogbin, who wrote the front-end Drupal book?
Okay, the answer was?
The Waking Alley.
Ally.
I thought it was Ally.
As in a passageway.
Yeah.
You spell A-L-L-E-Y.
Oh, yeah.
So...
I think I've seen it written somewhere like that, actually, one of the competitions.
I don't know, Laura. Some people are so pedantic, aren't they?
I don't know. The Waking Ally. It still doesn't make a lot of sense, but I think it's... Am I allowed to say what the theme
is?
No.
Anyway, so congratulations to Jan. Apparently we owe you another competition prize. You won the voucher in earlier this season, and we haven't yet sent it to you, so we have poked the appropriate person to send the voucher off on email. And Dave, what was the Ubuntu prize question and answer? Who won?
What was the name of the other book by Keir Thomas that we reviewed in the past episode?
Okay, and the answer was?
Ubuntu Kung Fu.
Ah, yes, the tips and tricks book.
Yeah, it was...
With the kitten on the front.
With the kitten.
It was full of very quick little tips. Yeah, we reviewed that ages ago, didn't we?
Yeah, it was back in season one, I think.
So who was the winner?
Well, the winner was John Uphill, and he states he's a long-time listener, first-time competition enterer.
That's pretty good going.
Congratulations, John. Maybe you should enter every competition, and then you might just have more chance of winning things.
Okay. Actually, entrants stand a really good chance of winning, actually, when they enter.
Yeah, it depends on the competition.
Yeah, you do have a higher chance of winning if you enter than
if you don't. Yeah, it's a bit like the National Lottery.
No.
You stand a better chance of winning than the National Lottery, that's for sure, though. Okay, well, congratulations to you two, and hope you enjoy your prizes. We'll get them in the post soon.
As soon as we can.
We have actually got another competition to start in this episode. We have an Ubuntu Oggio bag. Now, Peter Cannon won this bag and the raffle at OggCamp, but very generously said that he didn't want it
because
he's not exactly an Ubuntu fan, shall we say, and we can have it back to give away on this show. So that's what we're going to do now. So thank you to Peter for letting us give it away. And there is a question, and the question is,
how many presenters were on the stage for the show of OggCamp?
The live show we did.
Good question. Send your answers to competition@ubuntu-uk.org by the closing date, which is Thursday the 19th of November.
And obviously, we're shipping this, so we just doing this one to Europe, are we? Or just the UK?
Europe and UK, isn't it? Sorry to everybody else, but, you know, it's quite a big bag. I should say it's one of the Ubuntu Ogio laptop bags.
Yeah.
Sort of portrait style. Yeah. Not a backpack, rucksack style thing. It's
this is the one that was originally donated by Canonical, wasn't it?
Yeah. You can see them on shop.canonical.com, so go and have a look and then you see what the prize is like. They're really nice, actually, and well worth winning. It's time for the ecosphere. Oh, hang on, wait, guys. Alan's not here, so we can call this whatever we like.
Oh,
now, come on, Dave, you're the one who normally comes up with the ridiculous names for this segment.
No. I think we can point this one to Laura.
The bit about Ubuntu.
Ubuntu. I like that. That's what it's going for.
Okay. So, welcome to the bit about Ubuntu. I quite like that. It's quite good.
Yeah.
Okay, what's in the bit about Ubuntu this week?
Lots of people with sound problems in Karmic. For once, not the fault of Pulse Audio.
No.
Yeah, it seems to be all sorts of ALSA-related driver issues and things. I must admit, this laptop here that we're recording on tonight, I tried to play a WAV file for Dave earlier this evening and it just didn't play anything from Totem using the internal laptop speakers. It worked under the previous release. I will file a bug shortly. I've only just done the upgrade, I promise. Alan will shout at me if I don't. But yes, there are some issues out there in terms of launchpad bugs, and that's backed up with what I've found here, actually.
One of the things I've been really pleased about in Karmic Audio is how well HDMI works. It really does just work out of the box. You know, HDMI is the one where it's got video and audio in the same cable for like connected to TV and things.
Yeah.
And it really does just work out of the box, whereas in previous releases you had to do some magic to get that to work, and it does just plug and work. So that's good.
Cool. This is an interesting thing. In a change from previous practices, Ubuntu 10.04 will start out with a sync from Debian testing rather than Debian unstable. It's only for the LTS release, this change, although we're not sure whether it'll be for every LTS release, but certainly for the next one. It seems many developers were completely unaware of the change until someone spotted it on the Ubuntu wiki.
So that's next April's release.
Yes. So rather than Ubuntu normally before, just after the release, syncs with Debian Unstable, gets a load of new packages and things come in, throws out a load of patches, puts a load of new ones in. But for the next release, they're going to be going with testing, which, as we were talking about earlier, actually, with the Debian structure, is the slightly older versions of the packages, but that have had more bugs squashed in them, I guess.
So slightly more stable than unstable, but not as stable as stable.
Yes.
In some ways, it's actually making the lines between Ubuntu and Debian quite murky now, because it really is just a little bit above Debian insofar as the actual getting stuff a little bit newer, and then the theme change.
Well, it also depends on what point Debian is at in its release cycle as well, because if it's gearing up for a release that point, then it stops having extra stuff come into testing, because testing eventually becomes stable.
Yeah, and so we're essentially getting Debian, but with the
brown theme.
With the brown theme and the selected packages, which are the default installed. Yeah.
But as you never really know where Debian will be at any given release until you get closer to it.
I mean they do publish their aims. I think it's just a really interesting change. I think it's probably a good one, actually.
Was it something I've always thought that Debian benefits from Ubuntu, importing so much from it, is the fact that it's the unstable stuff, and we do a lot of their QA and stuff, and then push problems back to them. So we're actually helping the development release, and the fact that we're moving slightly forward means, are we being as helpful to the Debian project as we once were?
Probably not, but then an LTS release is a bit special anyway, isn't it? So I can see why you might be more cautious about the sort of packages you're pulling in. And hopefully it's not an indication that they don't think they can manage patching all the unstable packages to a stable state.
Making the unstable stable.
Yeah, exactly.
In 6 months.
Yes.
Mound Data Manager is a tool that can manage data in the context of other applications. You can take snapshots, delete, and move data from many of your favourite applications.
Whoa. That didn't make much sense to me.
What does it do?
I think, and it's bizarre, because today I actually said what we could do with is somewhere central that manages all the kind of settings and things for applications, so that when you migrate to a different machine, you can just take them all with you without having to work through every bit of software and work out how to export its settings. That seems to be what this does.
See, I mean, we're starting to see that actually starting to take fold now in some ways, because Ubuntu One is starting to do some of them things, and sort of sharing, you know, with your Dropbox and all the other sort of things about moving files and moving settings. I mean, something people have traditionally done is use Dropbox and then had put all their things there, then symlinked, so basically had a shortcut to the files in there as well as syncing files. So, I mean, the actual aim of this, I'm wondering whether how that works and whether it does it cleaner and sort of how it syncs. It seems to be an interesting project.
Well, it looks like it sort of snapshots your dot file settings. And perhaps we should explain that for those who don't know, on Linux, the settings for a lot of applications are held within your home area in a directory that starts with a dot, so it doesn't show up in your usual file listings. So a dot file is a hidden file, essentially. And lots of applications will create a dot file.
Like dot Mozilla, dot yeah. Tombow.
And dot gconf.
Yeah, and hold the settings for that particular application within that directory. But there are quite a lot of them, and they get difficult to manage. What this seems to be able to do is take snapshots of particular settings for particular applications and allow you to roll back to other settings or have more than one profile for a particular sort of application as well. So you can have default settings and also some custom settings. So if, for example, you wanted to have two FSpot libraries under one user, you could do that. You know, so you could use this application to switch to a different profile, and FSpot would load with a different set of settings for a different location.
And the blog post about it, I'm just looking at, says that it actually does the finding for you. So you run Mound and it will find all the applications that it's able to manage, and then it'll take the snapshots. So it kind of gives you a list of what's available rather than you having to go into each program and do anything.
Yeah, there's a screenshot of the application, and the applications it shows in the screenshot, which presumably implies it works with them at least to some extent, are Chromium and Firefox and Tomboy and Audacity and Gedit and Pitiv, and the transmission BitTorrent client. Also, yeah, so quite a lot of interesting and useful applications.
It's also got some applications there that I wouldn't have expected them to be the first focus point. You know, did you say Ardour or Audacity?
Audacity.
Oh, okay. I mean, that's quite a niche product that not many people really use. So I'm surprised they've actually focused on, you know, I mean, so if they're including that, they must already have quite a lot they're supporting.
Yeah, I mean, that was only a small snapshot. But it looks like a really interesting project, and it would be great. It's almost like version control for your dot files, but with actually a friendly GUI on top, quite a nice front end.
Yeah. So is that actually in the archives yet, or is that...
No, you're asking.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is a blog post.
It's available on Launchpad. Mm-hmm. I suspect there's probably a PPA for it. Hang on. Yeah, there's a PPA for it, so you can get it via that.
So no doubt that'll be in Lucid, perhaps.
Fingers crossed, it looks quite interesting. And that's all in the Bit About Ubuntu this time.
Long-term listener Tobias Richter emailed in to compliment us.
On a long flight, I recently had to endure some other podcasts. I usually don't find the time to follow many. And that made it clear again what superior quality you guys provide. That is both in audio quality and content.
Sorry, can I just stop you there? Did he say superior or superhero?
Superior.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Why would he say superhero?
I wasn't sure.
Superhero quality.
Maybe not about this episode.
Just referring to the show notes for your command line lerv makes it slightly pointless. I think you should spell the tips out and have the command and man pages linked in the show notes for reference and education, or leave it out entirely.
Well, the thing is, we don't want to be reading out echo $43 pound sign plus greater than ampersand semicolon bracket curly bracket underscore fidget woodla boom boom blah.
I mean, we did actually discuss this, didn't we? I mean, we actually did really think this through, and we decided it might make it a bit dry
and also difficult to follow. What do you do if you miss out a curly bracket? You've got to go back again.
And also, who doesn't copy and paste, to be fair? Everyone copies and pastes, don't
they? It's a bit of a pain if you're listening in the car.
Yeah, but you're not going to be doing it whilst you're sat in the car, are you? You're not going to have your laptop on the passenger seat and typing away, are you?
Because that would be dangerous, wouldn't it?
It's not really relevant to do it in the audio thing, when most people listen in the car or whatever.
Exactly. Hopefully we describe what the command does and maybe a couple of the commands it uses, if they're not that common. And if people are interested to find out exactly how it works, they can get it from the show notes.
However, if our listeners strongly disagree, then, you know, email in and... We can change it.
Yeah, and thanks for the nice compliments.
Yeah, thank you, Tobias.
Mr. Bitfolk, Andy Smith, chipped into the debate on software snobbery and why we should learn commands as well as GUI tools.
One day IP tables functionality will change. Webmin or whatever won't keep up. Your firewall won't work and you'll have no idea whatsoever how to fix it. However, if you're using a distribution which will guarantee to keep IP tables and the management utility in sync, no idea if Ubuntu does, then fair play. I've also lost count of the number of VPSs I've had to re-image for people after they have installed third-party control panels that break when the underlying distribution changes. I think the best idea is for people to familiarise themselves with the admin tools that actually come with and are supported by their distribution.
That's some interesting comments. I'm very guilty. I've read a book on IP tables. I did buy the book, but I've always used IPCOP to generate the rules and manage it for me, or Firehole on servers to generate it from a config file, because it's so much easier.
Well,
that's it. I mean, IP tables is so difficult.
No, hang on. IP tables has got a reputation for being difficult, and when you first look at it, it does appear to be difficult. But if you actually...
I'd say that probably makes it difficult.
Well, no, because if you actually do use a tool, like Tony says... Then when you've actually got the rules there and actually look at the rules it's generated, you can actually see exactly what it's doing. And therefore, you know, that's a really good learning exercise to be able to reproduce what it's done.
Yeah, it depends if you're interested in learning
it. Well, yes, this is true. I mean, now he does say he's not sure whether Ubuntu does or not. Ubuntu does. There's something called UFW, Uncomplicated Firewall. And it does make it a lot easier, because what you do is you essentially type UFW allow 22 or something, and then that will allow port 22 to be open.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So you have, yeah. So I mean, that is a wrapper for IP tables, and it works well. And because it's a Ubuntu application, it will always be synced with IP tables. So, you know, I think we're okay in that respect. But yeah, it's valid points.
For me, the proliferation of all these tools means that there's probably some underlying problem that it's trying to address. But yeah.
Stephen Fuller contacted us through the Ubuntu UK podcast IRC channel to tell us about the new look he's setting up in the north of Scotland. You can find out more at www.nos-lug.org.
Yeah, the IRC channel's got quite a few people in it these days.
Yeah.
It's actually Ubuntu-UK-podcast.
Yes.
Yeah, because traditionally the only real lug in Scotland's been Glasgow one, hasn't it, I believe?
There's a Scot lug, which is a whole of Scotland lug, but Scotland's quite a big area.
Yeah. It's
quite tricky for getting there on a Saturday.
So if you're in the Outer Hebrides or somewhere and you're interested in having a lug that maybe is fractionally local, more local than some of the other ones, go along to the website and help out Stephen and get involved.
Wonderful.
We've had lots of feedback about OggCamp too.
Yay!
Mark Johnson wrote in to say that we did an
awesome job with OggCamp. I thought it was an awesome day, and the general atmosphere was perfect complement to the shenanigans of the previous day and night. I look forward to next year. Smiley face.
Well, that's awesome. An awesome comment, Mark. Thanks for that. I think he was clearly bowled over with the awesomeness of the whole event.
Although I'm wondering if things do come out of the woodwork about what happened the day and night before.
For Mark Johnson, apparently.
Mark did a very scary version of Delilah on the karaoke.
That was worth seeing.
Do we have that in audio?
I don't, think but I think it's on the video. Internet somewhere. It's quite frightening seeing all these geeks do karaoke.
Yeah.
I still like to do geekyoki nights. I think set up touring geekyoki where geeks come along. Who says geeks are introvert and reserved? Really, on some of the performances on there. Josh Holland, friend of the show, long-time listener, his version of the Chef song from South Park had to be seen to be believed. It was incredible.
was that Ubuntu code of compliance?
It probably wasn't compliant, so I haven't gone into details about that.
We also had this just a moment from John, the nice guy, Spriggs.
Hi, this is a quick and my first ever audio note from John the Nice Guy. I just wanted to thank all of those who made Lug Radio Live and OggCamp a reality this weekend. Without the support of the communities around three of the best podcasts in the world, we all would have been richer in pocket but poorer in spirit. I also wanted to thank some specific people, John O and Ack, for torturing us all with the karaoke version of My Heart Will Go On that I'm currently uploading to YouTube. Tim Dobson for giving me a project I hate so much. I'm glad I gave you so much free publicity, and I hope you to buy me all my drinks at the Ubuntu release party in Manchester. To everyone who left me behind so you could all go off to the Chinese restaurant whilst I was still talking to my wife, damn you all. But seriously, it really was an amazing weekend. I'm totally looking forward to what I assume will be called OggCamp 2010, featuring Lug Radio Live and Unleashed. See you all next year, and thanks again.
Thanks for that. Sorry, Dave, go on.
I was going to say, that was really quite good, actually.
Yeah, thanks for that, John. It's very, very nice compliment. John was one of the bigger personalities of the day with his outrage at Pokebook.
and his funky T-shirt.
And his funky T-shirt. He's got a strange... He was wearing a glittery Stormtrooper helmet T-shirt on the Saturday night.
Yeah.
It stood out a long way. But yes, thanks for the nice...
So is it true what they say? He is a nice guy?
He seems like a very nice guy. Yeah.
Nice guy,
yes. Yeah. Until you talk to him about Pokebook, when he goes not so nice.
Yes. Quite scary.
Yeah, he goes a funny colour.
Yeah.
Michael and Rachel Hingley wrote a lovely long email with ideas and suggestions about the next Odd Camp, including getting people to do live Just a Moments and videoing all the talks. Now, the videoing thing has been suggested before, and basically, if there's anybody from the community, either the Linux Outlaws community or Ubuntu UK community or any other relevant community, who'd like to step up to the plate and do it, then feel free.
You're welcome to.
You're quite welcome to video the talks and make them available, and we'll link to them from the website. Quite happy to do that. But there's enough involved in the organising of the event to we don't want to have to do all the videoing and stuff as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've learnt a lot of lessons doing this. This was obviously, you know, our first one.
Our first time, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, now we've sort of learnt the lessons and, you know, and we have decided to run it again because it seemed to be success. I thought we had.
I don't think there's been any decision made.
Well, yeah, I think we've committed to doing something next year. We just don't know quite what shape it will have.
And so I think, you know, because it was a success last year, I think we can probably pull in more people to help out, and, you know, we can see where it goes from there.
We know what we're taking on a bit better this time.
Yeah, basically we need people to step up, and if they want to see new things there, help us deliver them. And the videoing's a classic case for that.
I mean, one of the things we were concerned about was we did have a financial outlay, and we were concerned that if not enough people didn't turn up, that it wouldn't either make it worthwhile or pay for itself. So now we've known there's a good attendance, then I think we can... We're willing to have a bit more risk, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. There's lots of things to discuss about it. And any suggestions and things are welcome to the normal email address and any other means as well.
And not only did Mike and Rachel write this lovely long email, but they wrote it that evening. It was there by the time we got to the bar.
Yes. Clearly a shorter journey home than we had.
Yeah.
We also had some social network messages. Matt B90 listened to the UUPC live podcast on the journey to work this morning and found myself laughing even though I'd been at the recording.
Well, that's pretty good going. I thought it was quite funny as well, chuckling away, but then I was kind of a bit more involved directly.
Chemical Oliver had never listened to the recording of a raffle draw after it happened, but is strangely entertaining.
Yeah.
We wondered how that would work.
Yeah, we did a few comments saying it went on a bit long, and yes, it possibly
It went on a bit long in live as well, not just on the recording, so you didn't lose anything there.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
we're spreading the fun.
Yeah. If you listen to the recording, you got the same slightly too long raffle draw that you did in the live event.
You just didn't get to see the prizes.
Soren listened to the show from Odd Camp and made his comment.
What's this one distro stuff you people are talking about? Have you guys lost your marbles? People are free to do whatever they want in open source, and if hundreds of distros is what they really want, then that's what they do. If sound is broken, that can be fixed. All we really need to do is rally people and get them to work on it. You guys can help with that. Start a campaign or something. Talk to Canonical about it. Put it out there. Complaining about everyone doing their own thing is not going to solve it.
Thank you, Soren. I think if you want to start a campaign, we'll certainly pimp it and help in every way we can.
Yeah, I think the broader point that he's making is, you know, obviously there is some inherent freedoms in the way the free software works, and we can't take that away, and nobody's seriously trying to suggest that we should do.
I think it's a good debate to be had, though.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole one distro idea is so impractical it can never work, but it does highlight the risks of spreading people and development skill and times too thin, really.
It also highlights the fact of just not going to extremes. It's not about one distro or about zillions of distros, but sort of just getting the point across that, as you say, spreading people too thin, maybe.
I'm still amazed there wasn't a discussion of, is this the year of the Linux desktop? I mean...
Maybe we'll do that at Odd Camp next year.
Yeah, I think that's penned in, isn't it?
And that's all your feedback. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to everyone who took part via Twitter and Identica.
If you'd like to get hold of us, you can email the show via podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
You can leave us a voicemail in a number of ways, telephone 0845 508 1986, or VoIP us on podcast@sip.ubuntu-uk.org. Easy for you to say. And finally, Skype us at Ubuntu UK Podcast, all one word.
You can send us your comments and get updates from recording sessions on Identica or Twitter, where we are at UUPC.
Alternatively, if you're into IRC, you can chat to us by the #Ubuntu-UK-podcast podcast channel. There's a lot of dashing going on there.
It's a dashing channel.
I think we need a cup of tea for that.
There's stuff happening in there too.
Yes, yep. So that is on Freenode and on the IRC network.
Yeah. Join our Facebook fan page. Find the Ubuntu UK podcast fan page on the Facebook fan page. Find our Facebook fan page along with 300 other people. Search for Ubuntu UK Podcast.
We welcome just a moment's command line loves, reviews or rants and feedbacks, both positive and negative. So please do get in touch.
And thanks again to our community of network mirrors on the website.
Excellent. That's what I got laughed at for doing two episodes ago. So it's great that somebody else has done it as well. Right, we'll be back in a couple of weeks with a whole different array of people, probably. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.